2021 Board of Directors conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Following today's presentation, instructions will be given for the question and answer session. If anyone needs assistance at any time during the conference, please press star followed by the zero. I would now like to turn the conference over to Bob Williams. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, and thank you everyone for joining us this afternoon. Participating in the teleconference this afternoon is NCA President Mark Emmert, as well as Ed Ray, President of Oregon State University and Chair of the NCAA Executive Committee, Judy Genschaft, President of the University of Central Florida.
South Florida.
South Florida, excuse me, and Chair of the Division I Board of Directors, and Walt Harrison, President of the University of Hartford and Chair of the Committee on Academic Performance. With that, I'll turn it over to President Emmert.
Well, good afternoon. We're very pleased that you're all able to join us. What we would like to do is make a few general comments about both the retreat that just concluded and today's Board of Directors meeting, because the two are closely related. I'll then ask President Genschaft to make some comments about both the content of today's decisions and the processes that the Division I Board will be using going forward. Then I'll also turn to President Harrison, who has been intimately involved in the academic reforms and proposals that we both adopted today and will be shaping in the coming meetings, and President Ray from Oregon State to also amplify the points that the presidents all agreed upon at the retreat. Let me begin, first of all, with the retreat. As has been reported in some quarters already, we had a day and a half of what could only be described as very robust, very frank, and frankly, exciting conversations about the nature of intercollegiate athletics as it is today, and focusing on the issues that we need to really be attentive to and act on in the very near future. We discussed three general areas of concern, the first being those around the utilization and allocation of resources, the second being academic issues, and the third being the integrity of intercollegiate athletics today. In the first category, around resources, we had very good conversations and concluded that we really need to give some serious attention and action to looking at our own rules and our own processes to make sure that we are not inadvertently putting burdens on our institutions and their athletic departments without focusing them where the resources really need to be, and that, of course, is on our student athletes to the extent that it makes sense. The second part of that conversation was again about how do we provide resources in appropriate fashion and support for student athletes. The presidents agreed to ask the Board of Directors and my staff to consider in the coming months, not years, but the coming months, a set of proposals to deal with student welfare, including whether or not we can move to a model that would allow permissive for conferences, permissive increases to the grant and aid for student athletes up to, but not to exceed, the full cost of attendance. There is complete and unequivocal unanimity that we should never, ever pay student athletes for being student athletes. The question is whether or not we can allow institutions and conferences to increase grant and aid to recognize the real and legitimate costs of education. Secondly, in that category, we agreed that we need to explore aggressively the potential of allowing conferences to consider multi-year grant and aid rather than single-year grants and aid, again, on an optional, not a mandatory basis. We also agreed that we wanted to explore in the coming months whether or not, if a conference should adopt a model of using either of those two things, there should be additional academic expectations for those conferences. When we moved into academic issues, we had, again, an extremely robust conversation about, first of all, the success of our student athletes, and recognize that the reforms of 8 years ago have had a significant impact, and we're very pleased with the positive direction that we now have. with academics. At the same time, we noted that there are substantial problems still in football and men's basketball, and there are some acute problems in the two-year transfer students coming into our universities. So we identified a number of things that we want to act on and indeed already have acted on in the area of academics. The first is that the Committee on Academic Performance that Walt Harrison chairs had proposed that we move from a penalty cut point of the APR of 900 up to 930. And there was great support for that move by the presidents involved, and indeed earlier this morning the Division I board passed exactly that requirement with a proposal to be brought back to them in October to determine exactly the pace with which we would make that change. Secondly, we had very good conversations and strong agreement that we need to look at initial eligibility requirements for students to be eligible to compete in intercollegiate athletics. We are going to be bringing back, again, through the Committee on Academic Performance in October or January at the latest, a set of proposals to increase the GPA requirements for entering freshmen, to look at the core curriculum requirements and the prioritizing and the sequencing of courses in the core curriculum, and also to look at whether we want to change the sliding scale with the SAT, ACT scores included. We also had very strong agreement that we need to do something quite similar to that with community college transfer students, to consider the existing academic requirements and to strengthen them substantially, since we're having such acute problems there, to require higher grade point averages, a stronger set of core curricula, and limit the number of courses that are in areas such as physical education that a student can bring forward from their community college work. We also, and it's been noted also in the media already, we also had agreement among all the presidents at the retreat that we needed to create a threshold academic score for participation in NCAA championship events and our tournaments. The presidents were recommending that threshold be also at an APR of 930, and I was very pleased that the board of directors this morning adopted precisely that recommendation, with the requirement that in October the Council on Academic Performance bring back again a proposal on how quickly we can phase that in and the rate at which we can ramp up from where we are today to a 930 APR for participation in any of our tournaments or championships. The third area that the retreat focused on, and that we had, again, very, very engaging conversations in, was the whole area of integrity in intercollegiate athletics. And in that arena, we agreed first and foremost that we need to do a very aggressive editing and, in some cases, rewrite of the Division I rule book. There's clear agreement that the rule book contains too many extraneous, sometimes unenforceable, sometimes contradictory, and sometimes utterly irrelevant rules. We want to quickly edit those. We want to focus attention in the rule book and also in the behavior of our enforcement staff, the notion that we have to be attentive to those areas that are genuine threats to the integrity of intercollegiate athletics. The presidents, of which included all of the members of the board of directors, were quite adamant also that this be handled in an expeditious fashion and that it be done somewhat akin to a base closureship model, where we will bring back to the board in the coming months and the next couple, three meetings, a set of proposals for those rule edits, and they will vote them up or vote them down, but that we will not get into extensive editing of that rule book, lest it all turn into a quagmire. We also agreed that we want to look at in the next meeting or two the notion of redefining the categories in which our infractions occur and to strengthen the penalties around the most serious offenses as they currently are, and to create a multi-category infractions system rather than the two-tiered model that we have now with just secondary and primary infractions. And with that, I'm going to turn to President Genschaft, who can talk a little bit about the resolve of the presidents to move in a speedy fashion and discuss a bit about how that's going to happen, and also provide some more details about today's Board of Directors meeting, which is, of course, distinguished from the retreat itself. The Board of Directors can and did today begin making official decisions. So with that, President Genschaft.
Thank you. Very glad to have this opportunity. Let me just say that the retreat was one of the most important events, I think, that NCAA has had in many, many years, as long as I've been here. And so I want to compliment President Emmert and all of the professional staff on that retreat. All of the members of the Division I board were at the retreat, so when the retreat was over, we moved into the session and made some very important decisions. One is that the board agreed with the report from President Harrison on the Committee on Academic Performance recommendation to raise the penalty APR threshold to 930 and to use the same score as a championship participation entry standard. We then directed the Committee on Academic Performance to return in October with implementation details. We also look forward to a discussion in October for initial and junior college transfer standards to come to the board and report in October and probably have action in January. As President Emmert had said, the board also directed him to come to the meeting in October with an action plan that will direct the board with various items and issues that were discussed at the retreat, which may include legislation for immediate adoption. One of the other items that I think is very important that we supported was that there be a continuation of the NCAA Division I Academic Performance Program Supplemental Support. And what this APP Supplemental Support Fund's purpose is to support campus-based initiatives that are designed to foster student athletic academic success at limited resource institutions. Grants have been awarded in the past for innovative solutions to barriers preventing student-athlete retention and progress toward degree completion. This program encourages sharing and adaptation of successful programs in all Division I campuses, including institutions that do not receive supplemental support. So by continuing this fund, it will it's really showing not only Division I, but all of NCAA's commitment to a meaningful program that encourages academic achievement and facilities, and it facilitates academic improvement. The other item that I think is important is the one that we had a unanimous support by the presidents of Division I to support the staff interpretation that the current bylaws do not permit youth programming. And I know that has been an issue for some, and that was an action taken
on collegiate networks.
On collegiate networks, thank you. Those were some of the highlights. We had some other action items, but I think for this call particularly, those were the most important that you may be interested in.
Thank you, President Genschaft. And now I'd like to ask President Harrison if he could provide a little bit of background on the new academic requirements that were approved today by the board and the process going forward to implement both the 930 APR for programs overall and the 930 threshold for participation in our tournaments and championships.
Well, thank you, Mark. First of all, I want to say I'm extremely pleased by the conversations we had at the presidential retreat, and I add my voice to Judy's that that was one of the most meaningful events I participated in my 9 years of association with the NCAA governance structure. And I was also extremely gratified today by the unanimous resolve of the Division I board to approve 930 as the cutoff score for penalties. Let me try to adjust. Mark encapsulated what we approved today, but let me explain a little bit in a little more detail, and then I'm obviously be available to answer questions. A 930 APR equates generally to a 50% graduation rate, and that is the stake in the ground that I believe the presidents in the governance structure of the NCAA wish to put in as an overall goal for every team in Division I. So it's a clear marker. You've got to make this 930 APR, which is a four-year average for each team, or else you would be subject to penalties. And we've had these penalties for some time that were set at 900, and over time that number had, because of other changes we've made in the way that the APR is put together, that number had drifted down to 35% to 40% in graduation rate. So this represents a ratcheting up of the goal for teams to avoid penalties. I think the presidents all feel that this is a very important thing for us to do. 50% graduation rate, graduation success rate, as we call it in the NCAA, is a reasonable goal for all teams and one that we think we can make. As Mark pointed out, the most important change in today's discussions is that the board also approved 930 as the mark you would have to hit in order to be eligible for postseason championships in all sports. And there were indications from Harvey Perlman, who is chairing a separate committee that's looking at a bowl eligibility in football, that they also would like to see 930 as an entry mark for bowl games in FBS football. So it's pretty clear, I think, for everyone now, 930 is the mark you need to hit. You need to be on a 50% graduation success rate trajectory. We realize that we need to give institutions and teams time to ramp up to that figure. So what the board has directed my committee to do next is to come back with a phase-in schedule, which we will do by October. We'll be working hard for the next couple months. And I would anticipate, I don't want to anticipate too much, but I'd anticipate something in a 3 to 5 year ramp-up period where you'd have an increasing cut score over that period of time. And exactly how that works and how we do that is what we'll be discussing in the next couple months, and we'll be presenting that plan to the board in October.
Thank you, Walt. And then finally, let me ask the president of Oregon State University, who is also chair of the executive committee, Ed Ray, to make some general comments about the retreat and the actions of the board today, and the resolve that we all heard from the 50 or so presidents that we've been with the past 2 days. Ed?
The presidents and chancellors at the retreat felt very strongly that there are issues we need to attend to, that everybody knows what they are, and we need to make some bold changes, that business as usual is not acceptable. One of those was the area of finances. All of us are wrestling with difficult budget allocation decisions on our campuses across the board, and looking for ways to use our resources as effectively and intelligently as possible. And so we agreed that we need to look at all of the ideas that are out there, come back quickly with suggestions, recommendations for action on how do we save on the operating costs of college intercollegiate athletics programs. And within any given budget, how do we make sure we're applying appropriate attention to student athletes and to their ultimate success as students, and that we're being as supportive of them as possible? And that led to discussions about whether or not we should consider close to full ride or full ride, full cost scholarships, and whether or not we ought to have multi-year scholarships. As a preface to that discussion, we agreed that Division I is a very big tent. We had some great discussion about the variation in budgets from $5 million to $145 million a year in athletic programs, that maybe one size doesn't fit all. So we talked about the possibility on a conference-by-conference basis we could make decisions about multi-year scholarships, about full cost of attendance, without requiring that every school within the division follow suit. There was real interest in hearing more about how we might be able to do that. At the same time, and Judy talked about this, there was a real sensitivity to the fact that there are institutions and conferences that simply are in a weak position relative to total resources, and that we have an obligation among ourselves to be supportive of them. Judy talked about some of the programs that we're committed to, existing programs that perhaps need to be expanded in terms of financial and advisory support, but that we need to be trying to advance student-athlete success across Division I, not just simply for those who may have the resources to move more quickly than others. With respect to the integrity of the game, I think there was a general sense in the discussion at the retreat that people are fed up with people doing risk-reward calculations and deciding, you know what, it's worth skating on the edge or breaking the rules because the benefits from not getting caught are pretty great, and even if you get caught, you don't get punished very much. And so there was a lot of focus on making sure we come to a clear agreement on what major violations are, and that may require us to have three or four different levels of violation that we look at. But for the most egregious violations, those things that threaten the integrity of competition, the fairness of competition, that the penalties are very strong and very clear, so that nobody finds it in their interest to make a risk-reward calculation that says you can be a bad actor and be successful in intercollegiate athletics. As part of that, I think there was a general understanding, and there's been much discussion over the years about the rules, but I think there was an understanding that there are some things that don't rise to the level of importance that they need to be addressed nationally by the NCAA. Maybe there are some categories of competitive fairness issues that can be addressed at the conference level as opposed to the national level. We need to discuss that. And there certainly are things that a lot of time gets spent on that don't rise to, I think, a level of importance that justifies the time that's going into investigating them. And the problem is, if you're spending your time investigating a lot of small stuff, there's a good chance you're going to miss some of the big stuff. And the real impetus for wanting to look at all of the rules and how they're applied is to make sure that we're looking in the right places at the big stuff, that we're moving quickly and effectively to find bad actors, and that the penalties are realized in a very quick and a very substantial way. Finally, we talked about the academic progress, and all of my colleagues already talked about that. I think this is one of the areas where, in fact, we feel we started down a road and have made incredible progress. We are, in fact, moving forward with specific actions to raise the performance requirement to 930 not just for acceptable performance within conferences, but also for being able to be involved in championships going forward. We need to take time to get the phase-in and implementation aspects of that right. But I think the colleagues who are with us at the retreat who couldn't be with us at the meeting today, the very clear message from them unanimously was start doing things now in August when you have the Division I board meeting. When you come back in October, when you come back in January, when you come back in April, as Mark said, this is about months, not years. And so my sense, seeing the intensity and unanimity of support for substantive, important change at that retreat, that those colleagues who weren't at the meeting today, they would feel very good about the actions that the D1 board took and have a sense of comfort that, in fact, we are moving quickly and responsibly forward.
Well, we'd be happy now to take any of your questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will begin the question and answer session. If you do have a question, please press the star followed by the one on your touchtone phone. If you'd like to withdraw your question, please press the star followed by the two. And if you're using speaker equipment, please lift the handset before making your selection. Once again, if you do have a question, please press the star followed by the one at this time. And our first question comes from the line of Dennis Dodd with CBSSports.com. Please go ahead.
And Shaft, I think I just want to clarify this. Is it my understanding that the televising of high school games on school and conference networks now is interpreted as being illegal?
Yes. The staff provided an interpretation of existing bylaws, and the board supported that interpretation that the broadcasting of high school programs is which could include more than just athletic competitions is not permitted under our bylaws.
Does that now cancel the summit scheduled for August 22nd, or is that still on?
It's most certainly still on because, of course, what we really need to do is get a better sense of the lay of the land here. This is a very complicated issue. That summit on the 22nd is really just an educational meeting to provide education for our staff and to begin to get our arms around this issue and understand it more thoroughly.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
And our next question comes from the line of Stuart Mandel with Sports Illustrated. Please go ahead.
I guess this question will be for President Harrison. With the new APR requirement to be able to participate in the postseason, will there be any, attempt to have the APR score, be up to date right at the time that a team would be starting postseason competition? In other words, it's a second semester event, or will it still be based on their score from the year before?
This is one of the things we'll have to look at between now and October. As you suggest, what we currently do is report scores in the spring, so it would, if things currently stand, that's what we'd use to determine next year's entry, but we'll take a look and see whether we could do something after the fall semester. I'm not certain that's practical because of the difference between semester and quarter schools, but that's what we'll be studying between now and October. One of the things.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Dana O'Neill with ESPN.com. Please go ahead.
I guess this is for Dr. Harrison or for Mark as well. I know a lot of college basketball coaches in the past have complained that part of the problem is players who leave early for the NBA opt to leave campus in the spring to go work out and train for their NBA chances and don't finish their coursework, yet that's counted against them. Is there any way to handle that, or is that just going to stand part of the way the APR is judged?
Again, the current way in which we compute APRs, if a student leaves school and is eligible, it doesn't hurt you. It's the ones who leave ineligible, and we believe, and have traditionally believed, I don't see any reason to change now, that institutions know this and can plan to keep their young men in sport of men's basketball eligible, and many of them do. So as far as I'm concerned, that's we've got that now, and we would keep that in place.
Dana, this is all about making sure that student-athletes are students, and the
mm-hmm.
expectation that we all have is that they behave accordingly.
Thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Michael Merritt with Associated Press. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious on the postseason ban structure. If you can talk about right now, there's a historical penalty if you fall under 900. Under this, if you fall under 930 for 1 year, do you go into a postseason ban?
No. First of all, I should mention that one of the things the board approved today was doing away with the difference between contemporaneous and historical penalties. So now there's only one set of penalties, and it's a 930 over a four-year average. So it's essentially the standard we used to use for historical penalties.
So how will you go about that?
But we're moving from 900 to 930.
Okay. So how will you go about calculating? Will you calculate even a one-year average at that point then or not?
No. Just it's a four-year average. That's what we've used from the beginning.
And will there be exceptions for schools that maybe fall below that, as there is now, if they show improvement and those sorts of things, and appeal process and all the kinds of things that exist now?
That's one of the things we will have to study between now and October, but I think the direction I was getting from the board is not too much leverage there. So I would expect to see if there's any appeal at all, it's going to be pretty tightly defined, and there may not be any.
Thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Steve Weiberg with USA Today. Please go ahead.
That was exactly my question regarding the waivers. Thank you.
Steve, I've never heard you so brief. That's wonderful.
And our next question comes from the line of Pete Thamel with the New York Times. Please go ahead.
Yes, this question's for Mark. Mark, the biggest problem in college sports last season was a father shopping his son for $180,000, and the school ended up with the kid, ended up winning the national title. For all the talk of unanimity and all the robust conversation and backslapping, how is what you've discussed the last 2 days going to change the culture where the best players are available for six-figure prices?
Yeah, Pete, I think it's important that we haven't gone through in painful detail all the conversations, but one of the recommendations that's been put on the table that we'll work our way through in the coming few meetings is that the definition of agents and third parties, and one of the I think most important components would be the notion that family members, now family members has yet to be defined, but family members who are representing a prospective student athlete or a current student athlete are in fact active third parties and therefore fall under the rules that govern those kind of individuals. And similarly, that the failure of one of those individuals to cooperate with an NCAA investigation and provide information would constitute an offense that would put the student athlete in an ineligibility status, so that we can have some leverage in those areas. I think you and I have chatted about this. This is something that we're all deeply committed to, and I think we're going to have some very significant and hopefully powerful tools for addressing it.
A quick follow-up question to that. Mark, as your first year has gone on, I mean, arguably the two biggest things you've had to contend with are these Auburn cases and Ohio State cases. There's a perception out there, Mark, fair or not, that Jim Delaney and Mike Slive were able to strong-arm their guys through and get eligible. And in the case of Ohio State, it really backfired and provided a black eye for both NCAA, I think, and Ohio State. How can you address that perception, A, Mark, and B, talk about the power of conference commissioners right now in college sports, with them being billionaire negotiators and fireman compliance guys? And is there a concern that those gentlemen, or conference commissioners, I guess, in particular, have become too powerful?
I think, Pete, you've seen in the past week or two conference commissioners being active partners in trying to address some of the issues we're describing right now. My experience with all those individuals and their presidents is that they're very like-minded about addressing the serious integrity issues in intercollegiate athletics. The notion that they are exercising undue influence in our decision-making in the NCAA office is just plain wrong. People who want to believe that, they're going to believe it, but I know the facts, and that's just contrary to the realities of the day.
Mike and Jim are pretty much unanimously considered, Mark, the two most powerful guys in college sports. Why weren't they at these meetings the last 2 days?
This was a presidential meeting. This is a meeting about the people who are actually in charge of the NCAA. Conference commissioners work for presidents, not the other way around.
Okay. I mean, I know Carl was there and Dan was there. So.
Yeah, well, we had representation from each of the major divisions within the Division I. So we had commissioner and AD from the automatic qualifier BCS conferences, the six conferences there. We had representation from the non-automatic qualifier BCSs, those five conferences. We had one from the FCSs, and we had one from the non-football conferences. So we asked those individuals to identify a commissioner or an AD that they wanted to have in the room, and so for among the BCS automatic qualifiers, that was Dan Beebe of the Big 12.
The K-State president mentioned on Twitter, Mark, an intriguing concept about head coaches being responsible for the actions of assistants. I haven't heard anyone mention that yet publicly since then, or seen anything written from Indianapolis the last couple of days. How serious is that being considered?
As we go back and look at all of the enforcement process in the coming months, we obviously have to consider the role of all of the actors that are involved. No one is more directly responsible for what goes on in an athletic program than the head coach. That's his or her job. And I think there's a clear consensus that everyone wants to make sure that they're taking responsibility for what happens inside their programs. What that looks like and how that gets played out at the end of the day is more complicated than you can say in a Twitter note.
Sure. Oh, thanks, Mark.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Brian Fisher with CBS Sports. Please go ahead.
This is for all the presidents. You raised the number necessary for suspending legislation and also overriding legislation. I was curious if that creates a separate process, especially for the FBS schools, because obviously there's only 120 and you've raised the limit to 125, so it seems like legislation can't be suspended by FBS at all going forward.
The decision that we made about the number of votes that it took to call for a vote for an override and then the number of votes for an override are Division I wide, and that hasn't changed. But the number of Division I institutions has changed dramatically over the years, and so we felt that this was an appropriate time to change both the number of asks required to call for an override vote and the number of override votes required to get the matter, any particular matter, considered for change. But it wasn't about one part of the division versus the other. It was about Division I.
This also came from the Division I Legislative Council that brought this up as an action item for us. We did not just all of a sudden bring it up. This came through a regular internal process.
And to kind of follow up on everything, you know, everybody at the table has been in college athletics for decades now, and there's been calls for reform. What was the impetus for this meeting and kind of coming up with a
Well, this retreat is something that I've been thinking about ever since I took on the presidency. There is clearly in everyone's mind, and many of you have written about it, a number of very significant challenges right now in intercollegiate athletics. And as I went around the country and met with presidents and commissioners and athletic directors and coaches and student athletes, it was clear that there was a strong sense that we needed to take some direct action on some big issues, and that we needed to do it with some dispatch. And so the idea of the retreat's been long brewing. The big high-profile cases that have occurred in the past handful of months, I think, was really an exclamation point that essentially made the argument for us that we needed to engage some reform, and we needed to do it at a pace that showed some serious intent.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of David Woods with Indianapolis Star. Please go ahead.
Yes, I had my question answered. Thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of John Solomon with the Birmingham News. Please go ahead.
This is for Walt. Walt, until now with APR, we've never really seen high-profile programs get hit with these bans. Do you believe that's going to change with this new measure of 930, or more likely just continue to hit the schools with more limited resources?
Well, you're asking me to speculate. It's a little hard for me to do. What we're hoping to do is to phase this in so that all of our institutions will have a chance, and our coaches, and will have a chance to think about their particular circumstance and how they're going to improve their team APRs. I think our experience is that clearly the ones with better resources are able to do that more quickly, and so we want to be fair, and that's why we're thinking about a several-year period to phase this in. But our hope is to be as equitable as we possibly can, regardless of resources. And as Judy mentioned at the beginning, I don't want to lose sight of this. I'm glad you asked me this question. We have traditionally paid a great deal of attention to our lowest resourced institutions, and we're going to continue to study how to do that. One large segment, although not in all of the low-resourced institutions, but one significant segment of them are the historically black colleges and universities. We have two conferences, the MEAC and the SWAC, that are made up of historically black colleges and universities. And Mark and Dr. Bernard Franklin, as the executive vice president of the NCAA, have reached out to them to have discussions on how we can best serve them and their missions. We've built that into some of our calculations already, but we look forward to robust conversations between Mark and Bernard and those presidents, which it's my understanding will continue in September, because we are committed to not only to the HBCUs, but to all of the lower resourced institutions within the NCAA.
A quick follow-up. I'm wondering about the front end of academic success for athletes. There's been talk about, obviously, reforming the GPA for freshman eligibility. Couldn't a lot of the concerns about educating athletes be avoided if there were limits to special admissions by schools? And has the NCAA ever considered such a rule?
Well, I think it's fair to say that all of the presidents and I agree that we need to have much more robust initial eligibility standards, and that's really what we've been talking about. You're quite right, of course, that part of the issue is that we have to have young men and women coming to our universities, whether it's directly as freshmen or transferring from community colleges, ready to do college-level work. And so we want to, first of all, look at what our current eligibility requirements are and how we can change them. We have a number of good ideas, as I mentioned, to increase the GPA requirements and to also address the core curriculum. We've seen too many students who take too much of their core curriculum in the last year, their senior year, or even squeeze it into the summer between the end of their senior year and the beginning of their college work. We want to see core curricula that gets spread across their high school years and allows them to develop thoughtfully and intelligently, and that forces also students to start thinking about their education when they're freshmen and sophomores in high school, not when they're juniors or seniors. In terms of special admission, we always have been and always will be sensitive to students with learning disabilities or a variety of other issues, and we'll continue to find ways to accommodate them. But we certainly want to see strengthened initial eligibility for students that come and participate in Division I athletics.
Okay, next question, please.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Lisa Horn with Fox Sports. Please go ahead.
Thank you. This question is for Mark Emmert. I want to go back a second for when you have a student-athlete reinstated. It's my understanding that since the NCAA is not an investigative body, all of the investigations that you rely on to reinstate a student-athlete are from the schools. I'm assuming I'm correct on this?
No, you're not. We are, in fact, an investigative body, and we have a whole unit of the national office that's all they do exclusively. So we gather an enormous amount of information about these cases. What I would like to do is ask Kevin Lennon, who's in charge of student reinstatements, to provide you some more information. Kevin?
Yeah, you're correct that the institution is the one who is responsible for declaring a student-athlete ineligible, but in terms of the gathering of information regarding what happened, we do work cooperatively very often with the institutions. You can call that certainly an investigation, but we're actively working with the schools to figure out what those facts are, and then at the end of the day, given those facts, it is the school's responsibility to declare them ineligible, and then the NSA staff goes about the reinstatement process once we assess the culpability of the students.
Okay, can I follow up with that for a second? I guess what I want to know is if student X in front of you and the school has supposedly done an investigation on whether or not this student should be reinstated, what percentage of, just rough, would you say, the documents that you have in front of you, the investigations, are done by the school?
Well, because often there's competition that is involved, you're correct that the institution would conduct the majority of that investigation internally to make a determination, have NSA rules been violated? That certainly happens the majority of the time. Keep in mind that with the process that I just discussed with you is the reinstatement of an individual student's eligibility. And once they're declared ineligible, the NSA staff will assess the culpability and the involvement of the student. That is wholly separate from the enforcement process,
correct,
which is what Julie Rowe conducts. And that is a completely separate process of which she and her staff will conduct much more extensive investigations. But the reinstatement process that we talked about is one that's done around just the student-specific eligibility.
So I guess my question is the NCAA possibly going to go looking into maybe changing the way that works? Because I think, going back to what Pete Sammel was talking about, it seems there's a lot of perception with college football fans that the investigations that the school do in regards to student-athletes sometimes look like, I mean, there's basically not a lot of incentives at the time right before a bowl to make sure that you've dotted all your I's and crossed all your T's, because you can claim later you didn't know.
Yeah, you know, obviously an obligation of membership is to conduct a thorough investigation, and when you're presenting information to the NSA staff that says, we want this student to be reinstated, as a part, again, an obligation of membership, they're to do a thorough job in presenting that information to us. In the event that that does not happen, obviously we have an entire enforcement mechanism that is designed to pick up those issues where an investigation perhaps was inadequate.
Okay, thank you.
Next question, please.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Pete Sammel with the New York Times. Please go ahead.
Mark, I'll keep it brief. There was a there was a notion that was bandied about, Larry Scott mentioned something I thought that was interesting about the lack of dexterity with the NCAA, and I mean even that the fact that you haven't passed a rule to close the Newton loophole yet, you know, almost a year later, sort of shows that, and it's no secret, that you guys can't move quickly. Is there any thought or was there any discussion to putting commissioners in charge of college football and college basketball, your two moneymakers, in having someone in charge that can make decisions swiftly?
Pete, I guess I haven't been clear enough. That's almost exclusively what we talked about, was how we manage key issues, very large-scale issues that we're talking about here, and do it with dispatch. I think that those who say we're incapable of moving quickly will be pleasantly surprised in the coming weeks and months. The idea that we haven't finished closing up the loopholes that you described isn't the reflection of our inability to move forward. It's a reflection of the complexity of third-party agencies out there, and I think I just described to you a minute ago, in fact, the way in which we intend to do that by determining that family members are, in fact, third parties, can, in fact, be third parties and agents who represent those individuals. So I guess I just disagree with your premise.
Okay, so there was no sort of discussion to the notion then, Mark, of simplifying the process, making it less cumbersome, putting one separate person in sort of separating college and football and college basketball, the two moneymakers from the Malloy colleges of the world, and trying to sort of streamline the sports that matter financially.
No, there was not any discussion of that, and had there been, I don't want to speak for all the presidents, but I think it would have been met with a resounding no.
Okay, last question.
And our last question is from the line of Laurie Schmidt with WBNS Radio. Please go ahead.
Mark, I know that this summer officials from Auburn and Ohio State expressed frustration with how long an NCAA investigative process can take to play out and the lack of clarity as to when resolution is reached, because these programs are battling recruiting battles this entire time and having to fight off rumors during that process. Did the NCAA agree to anything or discuss how that might be an issue?
Well, we certainly all want to make sure that we can move on cases as quickly as possible, and part of that is obviously a function of, first of all, how institutions and conferences cooperate and work with us in providing information. The average case where the major infraction takes something on the order of 6 months to resolve, and in fact, we saw a number of cases this year where we move very quickly rather than slowly. When there are people that are concerned about the speed with which a case is being conducted, you have to go back and look at what are all the parts to an individual case. When were the facts determined? Who knew those facts at the institutional or the conference level? When were those brought to the attention of the NCAA? What's the speed with which an institution or a conference responds to the fact-finding? There's many, many reasons why a case may take a long time, not simply because the NCAA is not doing its job or is being too slow.
What about the second part of that, Mark? The lack of clarity as to when an investigation might reach its resolution?
Well, cases reach their resolution when all of the facts have been uncovered, and again, that's a function of how quickly and how cooperatively an institution or a conference or others that are involved in that process participate. So if it takes forever to drag information out of a case, and you've got to, when you lack subpoena power, you have to develop facts in more creative ways sometimes to get people to participate in a process, it can take a while. But again, you can't simply say that the reason the case is taking a long time is because the NCAA is being slow. That is, in my experience so far as president, rarely the case.
Okay,
thank you,
you very much.
Thank you. And, sir, would you like to take any additional questions at this time, or would you like to conclude the call? Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference call for today. We'd like to thank all of you for your participation, and you may now disconnect.